When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Performance Anxiety. This week I speak with Alan Epley. At this point, I'd normally tell you what band he plays with. But there's so damn many. The Shiner. They're putting out their first album in 20 years. And there's The Life and Times. They're actually recording new music. There's his Oasis cover band, Broasis. There's the two bass project he's doing called Bird Hands. And there's his day job with the Blue Man Group. And that's just what he's working on now. He also hosts a great podcast called Third Gear Scratch that talks with working artists about how they balance their creative lives with everyday life. So keep an eye on his Instagram account at Alien Epilepsy to stay up with everything he's involved in. Follow us at Performance ANX on Twitter and Instagram, and we join our conversation with Alan Epley already in progress.
Hey, this is Alan Epley from Life and Times and Shiner, and you're listening to Performance Anxiety. And I'm glad you are.
I'm at the age where I don't know if I need my glasses to read this stuff or not. It's like, it's in that weird zone where it's like, I got to move my notes in or out.
It's neither here nor there.
Yeah. Or I just take my glasses off and I can read some things and not others.
You're a lucky man. I can't see shit without it.
Oh man. I used to be horrible. I got LASIK like 17, 18 years ago.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But your eyes eventually start to go back to what they were before. So about a year and a half ago, I started to realize I needed glasses again. So
damn it.
Yeah. And I was like, well, the only good thing is I didn't pay for the LASIK. So that was good.
That's good.
I got a free LASIK, which normally is a frightening thought. But
yeah,
it actually turned out okay. I won it. So I won a LASIK contest.
Nice. Oh, for real?
Yeah, for real. My wife and I had just gotten married, and she was working for a bank, and they had this event at the Chamber of Commerce, the local Chamber of Commerce, and I snuck in. I was a photographer. And so I snuck in to pass my card around and try to drum up some business.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, you know, she's like, just come in with me. They'll think you're working for the bank, and go ahead and start, you know, passing your card around. So this is before we had kids or anything. So I'm like, all right, yeah, no problem. So we start doing that. And I had just done work for an optometrist for their website. And this was like early on. This was like 2003. So it was pretty early in it with website traffic and all. And so there,
mm-hmm.
The optometrist was thrilled with the stuff that I had done. So I figured I'm at the Chamber of Commerce event. I'll mention that. I'll go to some optometrist. I'll throw out, hey, I just did your competitor's stuff. So check it out. If you like it, I'll do yours too. So I go to this one and the lady's like, hey, have you ever thought about LASIK? This is great. I'm like, you know, no, because I can't even put contacts in my eyes. I'm not going to let somebody do Jedi shit on my eyeballs. No way.
Exactly.
And she says, no, it's really great. It's a real simple procedure. I said, okay, next obstacle, if you can get past that, is I don't have the money. It's like $1,500 an eye or something. So mm-hmm. I can't do that. She's like, well, we're doing a drawing, and the doctor here is one of the doctors who pioneered LASIK surgery. And he likes to he does pro bono work every month. He does like a couple days where he does LASIKs. And we're doing a drawing for it. So I'm like, okay. I'm like, here, just take my business card. Let me know if you need some work. Okay, great. So like an hour later, I hear my name over the loudspeaker in the Civic Center. I'm like, oh shit, I got caught. They're going to have to kick me out. So I go up to the table. I'm like reluctantly go up to the table. I'm like, yeah, I'm Mark. And the lady's like, oh my gosh, you just won. I'm like, okay, what? She's like, something with the eye surgery. I'm like, oh, shit. So she walks me over to the table, and she's like, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad you won. I'm so glad it was you. I'm like, okay, well, how much off is it? Because it's always a percentage off. It's never... So she's like, no, it's free.
It's like, straight up free.
Yeah, I'm like, no, it's not free. She's like, it's free. I said, she said, you come to the office. We do a check to make sure you're a good candidate. I said, okay, how much does that cost me? That's free. I said, okay. He said, then she does the surgery, and that's free. And then there's a year of aftercare. Okay, how much is that? That's free. I'm like, are you shitting me? Said, no.
Wow. Yeah, okay. That's a lot better than we caught you smoking weed and jerking off.
Yeah, which they probably could have caught me for either way. So,
yeah, either way, and you got free LASIK.
Yeah, so, exactly.
And years of care. So.
Exactly. But after 17 or 18 years or whatever it was, my eyes just started to naturally go back to.
Yeah, they don't tell you it's not forever.
No. Eventually they do. Eventually you find out. And it's weird because I couldn't hold my hand like a foot away from my eyes and see anything. I was that blind. I was just ridiculous.
Wow.
It was terrible. But, you know, I mean, I can take my glasses off and see things. It just takes a little while for them to adjust and distances and reading. So I kind of wear them for reading and driving. But
I get it.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
Sure, man.
I'm going to come clean. Speaking of jerking off in the bathroom.
Right.
I'm a recent fan of your work. I've been trying to catch up, as it were. Mm-hmm. I found out about the Life and Times when I had the guys from Vast Robot Armies on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're obviously enormous fans of all of your bands and your work, and you guys have worked together a bunch. And I saw him working with Jordan Zadorozny from Blink of the Star.
He
was posting that they were on, and the album sounding great. I'm like, and I've known Jordan for a few years now, so I'm like, all right, let me check these guys out. I listened in, and I told Jordan, I said, I should have these guys on. Definitely, you got to have them on. All right. So I reached out, and immediately they're like, oh, you got to get Alan on. I'm like, okay. Tell me a little bit about him. And they're like, oh, he's in Life and Times. He was in Shiner. And I'm like, okay, I'll check it out. And so I've been kind of playing catch up. So I don't know everything. I haven't even heard everything.
Well, that's okay.
Just even from the Life and Times.
Yeah.
But, what I've heard is incredible, and I am really blown away by it. It's a three piece. There's only three of you guys.
Yep.
The sound is so dense.
Yeah.
It's even live.
Yeah, live we really try to fill up some space, you know, as much as we can without being, I mean, there is some level to it, obviously. We're loud live, but it's a reasonable amount of loud, I think.
Yeah.
But I think one of the main things we wanted to do was not layer like rhythm guitar over the bass parts,
okay,
and things like that. I wanted to be my own guy, and sometimes I'm just the high notes floating above, and then let the bass kind of carry the song with all of the chord progressions, kind of, and like kind of a pretty aggressive tone. And then Chris is just a great drummer, so you know, and he holds his own. So the idea is kind of comes from that, like Police kind of vibe of playing, you know, okay, where Andy Summers is kind of floating on top and Sting as the song and the chord progression, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so when you write that way and you record that way, then it comes out sounding pretty consistent like that live.
Well, I'll tell you what, the first song I ever heard by Life and Times, it was the first thing I ever heard by you, was Dear Linda. And the drumming on that is incredible. Like you said, that's just, I'll air drum to that at work. I'll be listening to that at work. And
oh, good.
And I'm just sitting there, and people are like, looking at me like, what is wrong with that guy? He must be listening to Phil Collins.
Right.
So, we'll be right back. But before we get too deep into it, I want to know more about what got you into music. You were born into a musical family. Your parents mm-hmm. were both music professors.
Oh, yeah. That was it. Basically, there was never really any other kind of choice for me in my own mind, not because they forced me, but I was just kind of bathed in it constantly. So it seemed like the very obvious choice for me. And I always excelled in it, you know, and I always enjoyed it, and it seemed like an obvious choice kind of. But yeah, mom and dad were the kind of choral directors, and they were the youth group, and the choir directors and ministers of music at these places and organist at these churches, Crescent Hill Baptist Church in Louisville. And a couple other different churches along the way, but it was always, it was a time when going to church didn't mean you were a religious zealot. You know, it was a time when everybody, it was more like this community we all kind of went to. And it was a gentler, kinder kind of time, I think, actually, as far as how that goes, honestly. I feel like everything's so divided. You know, if you go to church, you're some religious freak, you know, and it's like.
You can be, for sure.
You know, and like, I don't know if there's much middle ground in churches anymore. But anyway, that's what I was raised in. And you know. So yeah, it was always kind of built in.
So you kind of had the sense from an early age that you were going to have a career somehow in music.
I did. I didn't necessarily have it envisioned out exactly clearly, but I definitely did go to college and was a music major. My dad actually worked at the college and helped to get me in at the because I was such a terrible high school student.
Oh, I know that one.
Terrible student. Yeah, I was like I'd been divorced, and it was kind of a. It was kind of a woe is me time, I think, but I don't remember it that way, but I think it probably was. I don't know.
I went through the same exact thing, man. My parents got divorced between my junior and senior years in high school. Mm-hmm. And not like my grades were stellar to begin with, but man, they plummeted. And that really, really screwed me up in college because mm-hmm. I just became the angry kid in the mm-hmm. dorms. And
exactly.
Nobody wants to hang out with that dude for some reason.
Right. I don't know if I was angry. I was more just like, just fucking off, you know, and not being as consistent as I should have. Blowing off assignments and nobody was checking on me. We had bigger fish to fry. In high school for sure, you know.
Yeah, I did the same thing in college and that I ended up leaving school. I went up to Rochester for photography and then my sophomore year, I left for a year, started going back my junior year and halfway through, I'm like, I'm done. I'm not doing
this.
So
I definitely get that, you know. I stopped for a semester, but I did go back. So I was on like a 4.5-5 year plan and finished out with a degree.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I did the 15-year plan. I left, started a career and a family, and then 15 years later I'm like, you know what? If I want to go anywhere, I should probably finish that degree.
Yeah.
So it's not a photography, but it's your generic business administration BS in BA.
Right.
So,
right.
Which has done nothing for me. So yay, student debt.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what did you start with? Did you start playing guitar or was there the piano? What was your first instrument?
The voice, actually. I was quite a singer for a long time, but I would say instrumentally, you know, they tried violin on me in like second or third grade, and then that didn't take. And then piano lessons didn't really take. My mom was already teaching the class, and I just didn't take for me. I wish I had paid attention more. It would have made my college juries a lot easier because I had to learn how to play in college. But yeah, you got to learn later on, but it would have made it a lot easier. But I learned in my youth group leader at Crescent Hill was a great picker. And I learned how to play by watching him play James Taylor songs and things like that. Yeah.
So you're more the album rock influenced guy, the James Taylors and Journeys.
Yeah, it's my mom and dad's record collection. It's James Taylor, Carole King, Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Oh, man.
Some Beatles, Chicago, you know, it's kind of AM Gold shit.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Yeah, it was really good. I still think James Taylor is like head and shoulders above many of his contemporaries, and they're all, many of his contemporaries are fucking amazing. But yeah. I think this is like,
I'm a latecomer to him.
He's a big deal. Well, the Beatles signed him, so that should tell you something.
Yeah, that's true.
Like 20 and put him out. So they both played on like, Paul McCartney and George Harrison were both on that first record.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it. See, I've known about him forever since, because my mom liked him. And I think maybe that's one reason why I never got into him is because.
Yeah, it's mom's rock.
Yeah, exactly. Although she was the first one to get me my first Led Zeppelin album. You know, the first album I ever actually bought was Van Halen's 1984. And it was, we were a trip to the, I don't remember, it was like Macy's or I don't know, some Target type of store in New Jersey. And she's like, here's $7. Go buy an album.
Go do your thing.
Yeah. And so I couldn't decide. So I came over, I went over to her and I had Quiet Riot, Metal Health, and Van Halen 1984. And she's like, I like the cover of that one. Go get that one. So I got 1984. So
well, turns out you made the right decision. It's about 1,000 times the record of Metal Health. With all due respect to Metal Health.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, Randy wasn't on that one. So
that's right.
So when did you start playing in bands, like rock bands?
Well, in high school, you know, you start fucking around with friends, and like I played bass and with some buddies, and we played in the talent show. But it wasn't until college we put together a band about the second year of a couple dudes, and I played bass by that time. By the time I got to college, I had kind of transferred into playing bass.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just our college band was called The Industry, and then, three-piece, always loved the efficiency of the three-piece.
I definitely wanted to ask you about that because that seems to be a recurring theme of your bands. A lot of three-pieces. Is that by design?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even bands like with four members are still three-pieces, like, you know, the Doors and Zeppelin and, you know, that kind of shit. So I always loved how they recorded. And then an REM is another great three-piece band where it's generally, you know, just guitar, bass, and drums, you know, so they were very efficient in their recording and how they did it. They're over and how they would overdub cool things in the studio. And then they weren't required live. They just would like say, like if there's a bass line, like, REM would have a bass line and they would just kind of double it with a piano, the low notes from a piano. And so on the recording, you hear that piano pretty consistently, but then live, you're in the moment, they know the song, and it's kind of unneeded. The bass is already doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you're not
going,
there's a piano.
Right.
You know, it's just like they're doing the song, and it sounds perfect for some reason. You know, so I was really kind of always mystified by that. I love Police. I love Rush.
Oh,
And that kind of stuff. I don't love everything from every band. I mean, I think every band has made bad records, and you know, but.
Okay, so you bring up a good point. What's the Rush album that you don't like?
I don't really know much after Power Windows.
Okay.
I would say Caress of Steel is a little rich. They kind of missed their mark. That's what I think Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons would agree with that. But it's fine. It's got some good songs on it, Lakeside Park and that kind of shit. But some of it's too rich on there.
Okay.
But I would say after Power Windows, I don't know any of that. Presto, Roll the Bones, Hold Your Fire. I don't know any of that shit. Except
for
I would go see them at those times. But like the layering, the precision of their recordings kind of lost me. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See,
U2 is one of those great three-piece bands. You know, I really was fascinated. And that's one of those things where the bass line just is the whole song, and then you know you got the edge on top. But Rush,
yeah.
You know, back to Rush.
Yeah. At what point did you start to play with Shiner? Because that was your first real big time professional signed band, right?
College. Yeah, I had graduated college, and then the Industry played for about a year and a half after college, three piece, and then we broke up. And then the drummer and I started a band called Orchid, which turned into Shiner.
Okay.
And so we kind of – I ended up – when Tim Dow had offered his services, I kind of like – I was playing with Clayton Brown, my buddy Jeff Brown, like one of my oldest buddies from college. I was like, man, I think we're going to do this instead. And he was like, oh, man, for real?
Oh.
Yeah, but he goes, I get it. He's a great drummer. And, like, Jeff was interested, but not as into the whole thing. So it was kind of mutual. It was an understanding. And he's down. He's one of my closest, oldest friends. And that's Clayton. And he ended up making Shiner videos and a lot of the Life and Times videos. So,
oh, cool. Which are amazing.
Mm-hmm, thank you. Yeah, he's a, that's all Clayton.
That's so fantastic.
Yeah, so I fired his ass. Get off the drum throne. Start making vids, bud.
You know where your strengths are.
That's right. So he's a great drummer too, though, and a great songwriter. So I had another side project with him called Space Suit. So then Shiner started playing along, and we were just playing with our friends Molly McGuire and Season to Risk in Kansas City.
Oh yeah.
It was a fertile time at that time. There's a lot of other bands going on. And it still is a really fertile, musically and artistically, it's a cool town. And there is a scene consistently and some good support among most of the bands, seems like, you know.
That's what I keep hearing. I've had a few guys on the show from that area, like Vast Robot Armies. And Steve was on the show. He did an episode with me where we didn't really end up discussing Season to Risk. We discussed Swans for an hour.
So. Right.
He's a pretty big Swans fan from what I heard. So I had Michael Jura on, and he's like, oh, my gosh, that's amazing. So, well, come on, let's talk about Swans. Because kind of like with you, Swans to me was intimidating. I knew of them forever, but I heard one track a long time ago, and it scared me. And so, so I was kind of like, I'm going to.
No, it is. It's very powerful. That really defines Steve. That really is right on the money of kind of what he loves is Swans, you know.
Well, we had a great album, album show, and it was a blast. I talked to him a little bit about the scene and all, and he was mentioning, you know, how supportive it is, and he's, you know, he's owner of a couple establishments that really help support the area as far as the music scene is concerned too.
Yeah, the record bar is a big deal.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I got to get out there one of these days so I can check all these places out.
It's a cool town. What town are you in? You're in Toronto?
No, I'm outside of Washington, D.C.
Okay, you're outside D.C.
Yeah. So,
yeah, you should go to you definitely should check out KC. It's a cool town. It really is. I don't live there now, but
you've got a whole family going on right now.
I do. I do.
How in that? All right. So let's see. Where the hell was I going with all this? So we're at Shiner here. One of the coolest things I heard in my research was Shiner's cover of Only Shallow. I love My Bloody Valentine. I'm huge Valentine fan. That, to me, would be an intimidating song to tackle. You don't see too many people doing My Bloody Valentine covers. What spurred that on?
We just loved that shit and wondered if we could do it, you know, and wondered if it would be something we would want to do. And it turned out cool, you know. We were like,
really cool.
Yeah. You just kind of jump into it. We were on tour. We were in LA and we were in Anaheim and we went to, I'm going to decline this call here.
No problem.
They're dead to me.
No. don't interrupt my podcast.
All right. So we were on tour and we had some time scheduled we had a day off or two, one day. We'd been playing this cover. And we liked our version of it. Just kind of figured out, just kind of like, you know, the chords, a lot of the chords are difficult to pick. You just kind of like, everyone's faking it. I don't even know what the chords are, honestly.
There's a lot of noise.
It's a lot of noise, but then you kind of like, you start to discern exactly what the kind of chord progression is. And kind of like, you look up on the internet what the words might be, because who fucking knows?
I don't even, Belinda knew.
Yeah. And, right. And, It was at this studio with the first Sheryl Crow record had been made at, the where they did that Tuesday Night Supper Club record with All I Want to Do and all that. They had two or three hits off that.
Yeah.
So she was writing with like some like baller musicians. I can't for the life of me remember. It wasn't like Don Was or somebody, but it was like some kind of big deal. Sort of like big deal writers. I can't remember. But it was in that studio. It was really interesting.
All right. Now this is where, I don't know if you've ever looked that up on YouTube, because that's where I heard it. As soon as your track, your version of Only Shallow is done, it auto plays to some dude named Kenny Feinstein. I have no idea who this is, but he does an acoustic cover of Only Shallow.
And how is it?
It's insane. It's acoustic. I mean, there's definitely some feedback noise going on in the background, but it's unusual.
That's cool.
But it is really cool. I was really surprised at an acoustic take on it. So,
yeah, it's a nice thing. Do you know who Jose Gonzalez is?
Yeah, the name is familiar.
He's a singer songwriter. He's actually Swedish. Anyway, he did a cover of Massive Attack, Teardrop, and it's insane.
When you said he's Swedish, I think that kind of.
Yeah, he's not Hispanic or Latin American. He's just Swedish, I believe.
So how long was Shiner together before you guys decided that it had run its course?
We were a band for 10 years. Okay. 93 to 2002. It was somebody 92 to 2002.
And then was it an immediate transition from Shiner to the Life and Times?
It was for me, and we both went into Josh and Paul, and had started, and maybe Gherkin recorded for them or something, had started doing Fire 1666. So they had their own side thing, their own new band, and I had my own new band, and I had already been writing some anyway with another drummer, Mike Myers.
And it was just kind of him, So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bet you get that one open.
Yeah.
Never heard that one before.
Yeah. It is a very different kind of drummer for me.
Okay.
And both the Shiner drummers, Tim Dow and Jason Gherkin, were both like super proficient drummers, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so Myers is also a really great fucking drummer, but it's a different approach. Okay. And he can play slowly very well, and very like he can play like that Pink Floyd kind of shit, which is much more difficult to do. You know, if you give a drummer like something in 5 or 7 to play to, it's almost easier to find something. But if you just give them a straight 4 sometimes and something slow, mm-hmm. play something cool to that, you know, and fit the song. And that's harder sometimes for some drummers to kind of fit their mind around. Okay. And historically, the Shiner vibe has been kind of there's a certain math rock element to it, although we never set out to write. I never would like set up and go, I'm going to write in 5, 9 or 11. I just would kind of feel something and write it. And then I'd have to break it down later and realize that it was in a certain time.
Oh, wow. But,
I never like when you're explaining it to somebody, you have to go, whoa, fuck. Well, here's one. You know, they got to know where one is in the phrase when you're playing it for the guys. So,
okay.
So there's that kind of shit, you know, but when I write, I don't like set down for that. I really try to just get into it and feel it out. Yeah.
All right. So what's behind the name, The Life and Times? Anything in particular?
I liked it because, it was a kind of a weird phrase for me. It always seemed like a kind of a strange phrase, but it also kept I liked the sound of it, but I liked how it was, it could be very dark or it could be very kind of like, it could be foreboding or it didn't have to be, you know, it had different kind of connotations depending on what the music was like or what the cover art was like or what the title of the record was. So, you know, I liked its malleability, you know, and fuck, at a certain point, you just got to settle on a name.
Yeah.
It takes a long time.
Yeah. I can imagine. I'm trying to remember. I had somebody on recently and they were saying the hardest part of getting the band together was coming up with a name that hadn't been taken already.
Uh-huh. That's exactly right.
So, and the Life and Time sounds very literary.
Well, I appreciate that. The only kind of confusion that there's been is that I think Jay-Z has a thing. It's called Life and Time, Life Plus Times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so it's like his brand or something. So that's been a little strange, but like from more than that, we've kind of established it. So it's been good.
Well, I hear he's kind of popular. So like, I mean, it probably isn't too bad.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard the name. I'm not sure who it is. I've heard people talk about him.
I want to know what the Z is. Is that
getting a course?
Maybe that's Jordan Zatarazzi. He's just Jay-Z.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got to check with him.
That's good. It could be.
But you've got a shit ton of bands though. So you're currently with, let's see. All right, so there's Life and Times. Shiner reunites from time to time. Then there's Bird Hands, Broasis, which is awesome. I told my kids that you do an Oasis cover band called Broasis, and my daughters absolutely loved that. They thought that was the coolest thing on the planet. And you also perform in the musicals part of Blue Man Group.
I do.
How the hell do you keep all that shit straight?
Well, for a long time, I mean, Blue Man's just my job. You know, it's not my creative outlet.
Okay.
You know, I really enjoy playing it. I'm not a Blue Man. I'm playing the band.
Right.
But
you play Chapman Stick.
Mm-hmm. Play bass and Chapman Stick and some other like percussion shit.
That's a crazy ass instrument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we don't really play it like traditionally, like the way a lot of like Chapman Stick players, like if you come in knowing how to play Chapman Stick, there's a very good chance you will not get hired.
Oh, really?
Because we don't really play it that way. And I don't know. It's kind of a strange thing. But so we bow it, you know, it's tuned in fifths. So we bow it with if you cut the thickest bass string, you know, you cut like a 110 bass string into three chunks of like 10 inches each. And then we drag it across a string like a bow, like across two strings. So it ends up kind of like sounding like a cello.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty cool. But it's kind of like fast chunking, chicka, 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 pretty fast. That's not all of it. It was tapping and all kinds of other stuff, but it's a really interesting gig, but that's just work. That's not my creative outlet.
But you actually can now say you play the Chapman Stick and you can get a job that Tony Levin's not going to get.
I guess. Yeah. No, Tony, they wouldn't. Yeah. He's too good for us.
So how does the working with the Blue Man Group work? I mean, Is it improvised? Is everything, I don't want to say staged, but do you have like is the music portion of it scripted?
Yep. Well, the whole show is very tightly scripted, but it's got built in many different improv and floating template structures in it.
Okay.
So in different parts of the show, it's different every night.
Oh,
and there's,
cool.
There's audience interaction on certain things. So certain parts of the show are pretty scripted very tightly. And, you know, it's a big deal to just become a Blue Man, to figure that out. If they find the right people, the Blue Men are generally actors and they're not primarily musicians. The Blue Men, although they do play instruments, you don't get hired because you're a great musician. You get hired because you're the right actor and you look right in the bald and blue, as they say. Quote unquote, because you can get all these different stages of doing all kinds of stuff. And then if they put get you in bald and blue, which is like the third phase of, if you don't look right, you don't get the gig, you know,
it's wow.
Yeah. It's a strange thing. So, I mean, it's like kind of when you go on SNL, you have to have like a wig test, you know, and what do you look like? And they'll put different wigs on you. And some people just can't play different wigs. And so
that's crazy.
Wow. It's a thing. It's a thing.
So but, how many guys are in the Blue Man Group during a show? And how is it like a rotating?
it's kind of a worldwide corporation at this point. Cirque Soleil owns half of us. Like, they have like ownership of half of the whole thing.
So. When you're playing, how many guys are playing at one? In the orchestra, the band section of it.
We're in a loft floating above the stage.
Okay.
So there's three blue men, and then there's three band members. There's a drummer, a Chapman stick, and then an electric zither. And then the zither player also plays guitar.
Okay.
And the Chapman stick player also plays bass. So it's a power trio, or it's some different versions of that. And then you run these guitars and instruments and zithers and everything through a bunch of pedals. And so to try out is a thing, to even get the gig is a big deal. Most of them are much better players than I am. I kind of faked my way through it and that I was good enough. But seriously, most of the players are like shredders, and I'm not really that kind of player. And then just playing, every time you get together, you're playing with different people. So there's like 9 or 10 different musicians that are in the total band, you know, or maybe 12 or 13. There's like four drummers, there's three stick players, there's four zither players, you know what I'm saying? You're always playing with a different version of that. So you're always kind of hit sound check, you set it together with, you know, we always have a sound check every day, and you always have a post show meeting about your notes and what fucked up and what didn't. Mm-hmm. It's very much a theater show, you know. It's really not about getting your rocks off and putting your own stamp on it. Like, they're really going to know that, you know, Alan's in here. They're going to really going to hear Big A, you know. It's not, it's not really like that, but you do get to inject some of your own stuff into it and have fun. But just the main thing is to be a pro, you know, a fucking pro. It's, you know, that's the main thing.
So how many days a week are you playing with the Blue Man Group?
It depends. In the slow season, I'll have as few as 4 or 6 shows in the month.
Oh, wow.
Or in the busy season, which is basically March through August, and then again in the holidays. So there'll be like, I'll have like 20 shows a month or more.
Oh, wow.
So it very much is in seasonal. And a lot of times, so the dead seasons are more like September and October, and then January and February. And those are like the four kind of deadish months where I'm not there much.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now I want to ask you a little bit about Broasis, because first of all, the name's awesome.
Yeah.
But when I was trying to do my research for this, I was listening to some old interviews, and you had mentioned that you think that everybody who wants to actually start writing music should probably join a cover band of some sort just to learn how to actually write songs.
I think so. I mean, you don't have to join a cover band, but I would say in your development, the only model you can do is to base yourself off what has been done, and people have done the work for you. Just learn to play their songs. And then if you learn to play 20 songs, you're going to have a new song when you get done with it, learning these songs. And it will have informed you greatly on how to write a song. You might be a giant talent. You might just be so otherworldly talented that you don't have to learn anybody else's songs, and you can just write the best songs straight after you learn how to play guitar. But that's not most everybody. That's kind of like a 1 in 1,000 kind of person. If that's you or that's that person, then, you know, good on them. But I would say also they're going to have a certain ceiling on their development. And I think at a certain point along the way, they're going to need to learn. It just helps to learn other people's fucking songs, how to play, man. That's how you learn how to play.
Right.
Plus, it's wildly fun, and you get to really just enjoy the music and really enjoy their artistry and just get a fucking Eagles songbook and learn how this. I'm not even kidding, man. Those guys are master songwriters.
Yeah, they really are.
You know? And learn to play your acoustic guitar to Tom Petty and Eagles songs, and you will be a badass. You might end up playing songs that are like Neurosis or like fucking Rings of Saturn or some shit like this. But it's like you will have this under your development. You know what I mean? It's important.
Well, and most people aren't inspired to write music based on something that they're doing. They've heard somebody else's music Like, that sounds awesome. I want to do something like that. So that makes
total
sense.
You have to know the rules in order to break them or bake them. But you also have to, but you know what I mean? You really do need to kind of know what's already come, or else you're going to just end up doing something that anybody else is, somebody else has already done. You just didn't know because you didn't do your research. You just didn't know it had been done.
Exactly.
Like, listen to this. And they're like, oh, the animals did this.
Yeah.
We're the animals. No, man, this is us. Grandma's 90, dude. This is you know, you end up just like, and so I think it's important to do that research and learn how to learn your instrument.
Well, what I like about that is you've taken your own advice to heart, because you're in Oasis cover band, but you've also done things like Life and Times Doppelganger EP, where you've done a variety of different tracks. You know, you did a Tom Petty cover. You did The Romantics, which that is amazing. I don't know what you guys were, or how that became an idea, how you wanted to pick.
Smoking so much meth and PCP that it just seemed like the right thing to do, man.
Man, well, yeah, because it's such a creeper song, and you guys made it even creepier.
Yeah, it is. Well, there definitely is some real creepiness in it when you think about the lyrics. And,
yeah.
We enjoy it. Like, my development now, like, we're not doing Broasis in order to, like, we're just doing Broasis to, like, have fun and have some beers and play somebody else's music, you know?
Yeah.
And play some hits. It's just a real release. And then it turned out it was a lot better than it should have been. It was me and some other bartenders. I'm a coctologist over at a really great whiskey restaurant here
in Chicago. That could be taken the total wrong way.
Yeah. Mixology.
Yeah. I think I've called my friend a coctologist once.
Uh-huh. Right. But kind of I'm kind of a whiskey enthusiast. And so I've done a lot of work on that. And at this place, Longman and Eagle. So a bunch of the bartenders got together there, and we all just had been playing Oasis on the system there, and we were like, let's just do this, and got together, and it was immediately pretty great. So,
well, it sounded awesome. It's hard to tell, though, because I was trying to listen to some of the videos on YouTube, and the music is great, and then as soon as the lyrics kick in, I hear just whoever's holding the camera is
singing along.
Yeah, it's a bunch of dudes singing, and I'm just like, I can't really tell where Alan is, because it's just some dude singing.
Crowd sing. That's right. That's the beauty of playing some 12 million selling hit. Everybody else knows all the fucking words.
No kidding. And so you guys focused on Oasis and their hits. I mean, was there any thought of expanding it, or just Oasis is just like, everybody's fans of Oasis, because there's no Verve in it. There's no, I mean, I'm a big Britpop fan. I mean, I love Oasis, Verve, Cast, Reef, love all those guys. And I know most people wouldn't know a Reef song if you threw it at them, but Verve song here or there, but Oasis was...
It's about a love of Oasis. We just love Oasis mainly, and just we love Noel and Liam and the songs and just the purity of it. You know, it was interesting. I really didn't love them for the past 25 years. Besides Champagne Supernova, which I thought was maybe one of the best songs ever written.
I agree.
So I had this kind of active disinterest of them from the very beginning, from the 90s and throughout all of it. It was very it seemed like very too much stock, or too kind of default. The chord progressions, the solos. Mm-hmm. I still think the solos are a little default, kind of stocky. Nothing against his playing. I just think he's not the greatest soloist.
Yeah,
I think he's a great guitarist and a great songwriter. And But like, so like I have a hard time telling the solos apart. They all kind of sound like, you can tell some, but you know.
No, I agree with you. I agree. Solos are not Noel's strong point.
Yeah.
Songwriting.
Like undying love of Champagne Supernova. Even when I was like deep into Shiner, you know, at that time, mid 90s, I was like, this song rules. All the other shit I don't even understand, you know, but like, so now, but then I kind of like transferred it and I like started to hear it and it's just so good and more timeless.
It really is. It Oasis is one of those bands. And it's funny because you'll start playing some songs and people, I forgot about that song. That's a great song. But you kind of keep it within that few year period where they kind of ruled the airwaves, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, if you go out playing some obscure Oasis song, they're just going to think it's your stupid obscure song. So, I mean, you might as well play the hit or at least stuff. I mean, as we go along, we'll probably pull out more of the hits as it, you know. But, I mean, there's 10 songs that people would know that we're not playing right now. But we'll add that in. And it's just fun. I mean, it really is just fucking fun. And we're not trying to, like, kill it. I mean, we're just – I mean, we want to play good and play well and have fun shows, but it really is a euphoric kind of just fun. We're not trying to be too serious about it. So,
well, I mean, you guys look like you're having a blast up there and everybody in the crowd is having a good time.
It's euphoria in the crowd. We've had two of those kind of like really crazy, just those kind of mystical shows. The first one here in Chicago at a room called the East Room, which is closed now. And then the second one, was at the second euphoric show was at Mini Bar in Kansas City.
Oh,
and it's like everybody just fucking freaking out and singing along, and it was just like beer, and it was just amazing. It was really fun.
That is awesome. Because I don't see a whole lot of cover bands out there lately. Locally,
it's a thing coming back around.
I hope so.
It's tribute bands, cover bands are one thing. That's more of like a corporate and a wedding kind of thing.
Okay, and they do a wide variety of stuff.
More often. What you say?
Cover band implies, I guess, they'll do other – they don't focus on one band.
Yeah, we're more like a tribute.
See, it's a tribute band. I know we got to – and I got to check these guys out now because of how good you guys are. And the fear is always that the tribute band is going to be not so good.
Uh-huh. But oh, yeah.
We've got a Rush tribute band here. Look, now I feel like I need to go check them out.
Yeah, you should. Well, the thing about us is we don't try and dress like them. Well, we don't try and do that. We just have these lights behind us, and it's loud, and you keep the front lights low. We just kind of, like, make it sound right. But we're not trying to, like, dress like Oasis.
Right, right.
Because who could? No one's got the money to dress like those guys.
Or the eyebrows, man. Those
$1,000 sneakers, yeah.
All right, so Bird Hands. It's a fun word to say, but it's also a band. Tell me a little bit about this whole project, because this sounds interesting to me.
It's cool. This is a project that we had where it's just me and a buddy who've known each other for a long time, Ian Prince. He's a great drummer from Minneapolis. Plays with a lot of different bands, but historically people would know him from a band called Houston that toured with Shiner and Story of the Sea. And he's a kind of a session guy all around Minneapolis, and now he plays with Soul Asylum and a band called Porcupine.
Okay.
So he's doing really well. But he and I have been longtime friends, past 25 years, and we had an idea to just kind of to make some tracks where we weren't in the same room together. I would just put all the it's all just bass and drums.
Okay.
So I did everything on my studio to a click, and I would send him the file. And then he took it to to his studio and had some dude record it and would send me back the tracks. And we didn't go, maybe go to the hats on this section and then go to this on this, do a float. We didn't do any of that. And he didn't ask it of me. He just put parts to the song. And so when he sent it back, it was done. And I did a little mix, but then we ended up having, so we did 9 songs and we ended up having, Jay Robbins remix it. You know Jay from Jawbox.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
He was in, well, that's your area. You got to know that.
Yeah.
You're supposed to know this. So. Yeah.
I'm not real good with everybody's names. Band names I'm good with.
Okay. Well, Jawbox, that's Jay Robbins is a very prolific and great engineer and producer got a studio in Baltimore called Magpie Cage.
Okay, yeah.
Anybody wanting a pro record should go there for sure. Or my place.
Yeah.
But his is a much more thorough studio than ours, you know. But he's a really, really great musician and engineer. Anyway, he mixed it. And it's just like bass and drums. But there is some guitar sounds in it, but it's just bass sounds that I kind of manipulated.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So that's it. We played together for the first time in a practice about 2 weeks ago. It's going to work.
Oh, awesome.
Full in it. Yeah. It was always like, is this going to fucking work? I didn't know how it was going to go. And it turns out it's going to work. And we were delighted by that. And so Shiner is we're going to delay our release of Bird Hands until about September, I think.
Okay.
Because Shiner has made another record, and that is released in early May.
Okay, good. All right. So Shiner's got a new album. You got Bird Hands with an album in the fall. Is there any news with Life and Times?
Yeah. It's at a slower clip, but yes. And we just played a new song the other night when we were playing at the Metro here in Chicago.
Okay.
So we have about three new songs, and it took a while after the last record. We have five records. It took a while after the last one for us to kind of find where we wanted to go and where we're feeling. We love each other and we love playing live and we think we're amazing.
I think a lot of people think that too.
Well, I mean, but thank you. But like we love who we are and how we play, and we love being together as just me and Chris and Eric. We love riding in a van together and playing shows and blowing minds at great shows, you know, and so we will continue to make music and to do this, but we're going to have to stagger it, and we're going to be writing all this time when Shiner will be touring and stuff. So
you've got all these bands. You also 10 Bar. You're in mm-hmm. Blue Man Group, and you do a podcast, Third Gear Scratch.
Yeah.
Where do you find the time to do this? And what inspired Third Gear Scratch?
Third Gear Scratch is an exploration of wanting to find out how other musicians exist, because I think there is some illusion that's created that if you've seen somebody on TV, you think they're rich. And there's also the illusion that if you've never heard of this person, that they must not be making a good living. And that's also can be bullshit.
Yeah.
Many bands are not on the cover of many magazines, but also can make a great fucking living doing it. You talk to bands like Murder by Death, they're making a fucking killing, but they're not in Rolling Stone. There's also actors. Some of the Blue Man guys that I work with are, some of them have jumped off of being in the full-time Blue Man thing, and they only do it sometimes. They come back for extra money.
Okay.
And so a lot of those guys are actors, you know, and so doing the Blue Man gig for them is not their destination. It's a really wonderful honor to be a part of it and a great paying gig, but they may not feel like it's their artistic destination.
Right.
So some of them jump off and go to LA, and then they come back and do coverage over the holidays or busy times, word, and they make money. So some of those guys are on shows like Amazon Prime's reboot of The Tick, you know.
Yes, I love The Tick.
And they're on True Blood, and they're on True Detective, and shows on Nickelodeon like Harvey Danger, and they do voiceover stuff, and they're, you know, they're busy actors, you know. And and one of the ways that I guess it was kind of a Third Gear Scratch was started as a way to address my own kind of neuroses. And it's a bit of therapy for me. As I've grown older, I'm still in the business. I guess I thought for a long time, I might be in academia or in some other kind of job at this point, but I'm not. I'm a 51-year-old man. I'm still like making music, which is strange to me, and raising a family. My wife still loves me.
Hey, that's
people
good.
People still buy our records. We still, I can go out and do a good tour and play to people and make money. And that's all stuff that I don't overlook. But I guess I get to a point where I'm like, well, what the fuck am I, why am I, and what does that, is anybody else in this situation? You know, you ever wake up in the middle of the night and go, what the fuck am I doing? You know,
every night.
Mm-hmm. So that's that. And that's kind of where I've been talking to the different filmmakers and actors, comics. I'm talking tomorrow. I'm talking to the main stage, director of Second City here in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's who I'm. And we're going to talk to her about her. She is also a stage manager at Blue Man.
Oh, cool.
And she just loves Blue Man. So she got the gig there, even though she's there at Second City dealing with these like future TV stars. Every night I went and saw the show 2 weeks ago. It was fucking fabulous.
I'm going to definitely tune into that. I'm a big fan of Third Gear Scratch. I've been listening to a lot of the episodes. I've been catching up on those too. I've done some improv, and I love, so I'm incredibly interested in that episode.
Yeah, for sure. It's improv is like, I historically, I'm fucking allergic to it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so, it's like every time I see it, I go, this shit needs a rewrite.
Yeah.
This was the main stage guys had, they worked out a show and they do it for about 2 or 3 months. And so it is a themed show. And so they had, out of some of their improv sketches, they grew an entire hour and a half long show and
wow.
created it with about 8 or 12 different sketches.
Okay.
I just got a text from Jackie right here as I'm talking to you, just confirming for tomorrow. She's on it. Stage director is what.
Oh,
she
yeah.
does.
That makes sense.
I'm really fascinated by just how you would get into that. I think so many people and so many people's parents would go like, you're going to do what? What are you majoring in? I'm going into theater, Mom.
Yeah.
No bullshit. You know, it's like, I'm going to be a musician. I can't tell you how many times many people were like, what the fuck are you going to do with a music degree? You know? And I was like, I'm going to be a rocker, man. And they were like, okay, dude, you know, and like, it has worked and also not worked in a lot of ways. You know, as soon as I got out of college, I think I delivered pizzas for 8 years, you know,
yeah.
while I was on tour, but like, it was a great way for me to make plenty of money to exist on. And so the service industry is still something I lean on as far as tending bar. The schedule is super flexible. I'm there 2 days a week. And that's it's great. Like, yeah, I can leave for months on end,
yeah.
you know? And so historically it's been a way for me to exist, but the whole, I talked to a lot of people on Third Gear Scratch about this kind of stuff, you know, and what do you do? Yeah. What have you done? What are the jobs you do? You know, how do you exist?
Yeah. And some of my favorite episodes were with Steve Tulipana, with Mario Quintero and Luis Maldonado. You know, they're telling about all the different things that they do throughout the year when they're not touring. And it's really fascinating. I mean, you do now, and I was looking at the notes, you do stuff like, so you've composed music for short films, some commercials, documentaries.
Oh, yeah.
And Shiner's The Egg was used in a Jeep Wrangler commercial in Mexico. Pretty crazy.
It was pretty great. I think it was it was played, I don't want to say it played in the Super Bowl, but maybe, and like it shown only in Mexico.
Oh wow.
Interesting. So it kind of limits your take.
Yeah.
It was a big payday, but it wasn't quite the same payday that it should have been.
Yeah. Hey man, you know, if I get anything that I've done out there like that, I would be thrilled. My photography kind of stays local at this point.
Right.
Because I remember getting the same kind of comments. What are you going to do with a photography degree? Can't you just go out and shoot pictures?
Really? Yeah. I mean, somebody's got to take Getty photos.
Yeah, exactly. And I
think, you know, taking photos, especially in this day of phones, the people who can really do it are something special. You know, I mean, it's not just, you know, any knucklehead, any 6-year-old can take a kind of cool photo.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of, or at least once, but to do it consistently and know what to weed out and see, you know, like sports photographers are and political photographers just like off the charts and pro, you know, I mean, it's great.
A friend of mine, the photographer, he's old timer. He shot over 900 album covers. I mean, some of the most
famous shit.
Yeah. Check out a guy named Jim Cummins. He shot Hendrix. He shot Led Zeppelin. He shot a bunch of stuff. He was one of my early guests on the show, and his stuff is amazing. He's still out there shooting. He's probably late '60s, early '70s. He's still shooting, right. And his stuff is amazing. He shot the NBA for years.
Wow, that's pro shit, man.
Yeah, the guys. He's inspirational to me. He's one of the guys that really made me think. I want to get back into it because I dropped out of it for years, raising my own family. And I got three teenagers now, and we're kind of at a point now where I can go back out. I love music photography. I can go out and get I've hooked up with a local blog, Park Life DC, and they'll give me media passes for whatever shows I want. So I just shot Woven Hand on Monday with David Eugene Edwards.
That's great.
So
that's fucking awesome.
Yeah,
I think there are things to do in anybody's chosen field. I mean, in particular photography, another girl I'm going to be talking to soon is now a VP at Sony, one of my wife's really good friends.
Oh, wow.
She's a VP of like publicity. So she has to get Brad and Leo and Quentin together for photos, not even shitting.
Wow.
That's what she does. She's like, okay, stand up, Leo, come forward. Okay, cool. We got it. And, blah, blah, blah. And so a lot of it is like wrangling people together.
Yeah.
To do it. So her degree has gotten her to Hollywood and like into shooting with big, you know, all kinds of shit. She went to brought my wife with her to Italy to do that second Tom Hanks film for the Dan Jones books, the
Da Vinci Code ones.
Yeah, it was the one who was like something else. So she was hanging around. It's like it's all Tom Hanks and crazy people, and yeah, it's nonsense.
It's insane.
It is insane, you know. And people think, you know, don't get a fucking photography degree. Well, fuck you, I'm going to do it, and this one, you know, this is what's going to happen. You can never say that because you never know, but I also think if you just hang around and keep doing it, good things will happen, and that's kind of part of, you got to stay around doing it.
Yeah, exactly, and I think you're absolutely right, and just persevere. If, you know, if you've got the talent, like, you know, hopefully I think I do, and mm-hmm. like, you do musically, things will work out, and I know I've taken up about an hour of your time, man. I really do appreciate you spending so much time with me and chatting with me. And we kind of did it backwards this time because normally I'll have somebody on, we'll do this show, and then I'll invite them back on to do another show. We did it the other way around. We did our shit 80s drummers episode first.
That's right.
But I will extend the invitation. If you ever want to come back on and talk something bizarre, something totally not related to Life and Times, Bird Hands.
Yeah.
Or when those do come out, always welcome to come back on and talk about them. And thank you so much for chatting with me. It's been a pleasure. Oh, wait, before I let you go, I totally forgot. I threw out that I was going to have you on to some people and to see if they had any questions. And I got some responses. Let's see. John Agee he said, you guys had some awesome barbecues after recording sessions with Vast Robot Armies.
Yeah.
And he said he wanted me to ask you about Longman and Eagle antics.
I don't know if there's any, including John or including just normal Longman and Eagle antics.
I don't know. He's a little vague in his text.
Yeah. Well, Longman and Eagle is full of hijinks and antics anyway. It's a really really interesting whiskey bar and Michelin star restaurant and a hotel.
Wow.
And so things can get. Things get wild there, man. It's they have a lot of like kind of dollar beer kind of vibe there also. But you can drink a cheap Old Mill or PBR, but you can also drink a $600 shot of, you know, some rare whiskey. So it's a really interesting, not even kidding, like that's for real. Amazing. It's a very high and low kind of mix up.
All right,
but there's all these hijinks going on there, man.
Yeah, he wasn't specific, so we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Jason Thompson wanted me to ask you about the time the Amish kid interfered with Moustakas' home run during the 2015 World Series. He said it was really a double.
Well, that's really interesting. I the Amish kid. I'm drawing a blank on that. He's getting specifics. He's Canadian bullshit he's pulling on me.
So we got one too vague, one too specific.
Yeah, it's too specific.
Let's try to hit the middle here. Steve Tulipana wanted me to ask you about the God Pipe.
Oh, the God Pipe. God Pipe was our fictitious but semi-regular industrial band in the early 90s. It was me on the drum kit, Sean Sherrill on the scuzz bass, and then a couple more. Steve was screaming, and we always had the lights off, and we were always it was a very kind of like very heavy kind of thing. And so we had this fictitious singer named Clobber, and he had left the band, and so we were his Clobberites. But we was always like, what would Clobber do at this point? So.
Sounds a bit Death Clock-y.
It was kind of, it wasn't even that. It was more like industrial. So it was slower. I couldn't play. It was like, over and over, you know.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And Alan, I appreciate all your time. Thank you so much for coming on with me.
Totally, dude. Glad to do it.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.